From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
America strikes back. Afghanistan is pounded with bombs and missiles from the air and sea.
We are supported by the collective will of the world.
That was a sample of U.S. news coverage 13 years ago Tuesday as the U.S. began its overt war on Afghanistan. President George W. Bush was acting under a congressional authorization for the use of military force adopted by the Congress on September 14, 2001, with a vote of 420 yeas, 1 nay, and 10 present not voting in the House, and 98 yeas, no nays, and 2 present not voting in the Senate. Despite the post-9/11 announcement and authorization of hostilities, the U.S. had actually been involved in war in Afghanistan since the Carter administration 20 years earlier. Former CIA case officer John Stockwell predicted the current situation in the region with remarkable prescience in a February 1989 interview about U.S. involvement in Afghanistan since the Carter administration.
The U.S. is working very hard. They hope to take the capital and establish a government and then reinforce that government as it dominates the others and establishes some kind of peace in the country. The process is going to be extremely bloody. And the U.S. will be doing its very best with the U.S. media, probably not giving us the vivid clippings of the horrors, you know, as they're happening, just as they're not doing it in El Salvador or Guatemala today.
But couldn't there be an embarrassment for the U.S. if it turns out to be a bloodbath, that the U.S. supported rebels turn out to be barbaric and there's atrocities committed everywhere?
Well, there is a bloodbath happening right now, and it's just not being run in our media.
The media,
and
I mean,
we're not being told about
the U.S. and the CIA have done this continually through the years.
That's absolutely
in South Vietnam, in Iran with the Shah, in El Salvador,
with different degrees,
bloodbaths all the time,
but and with different degrees of collusion from the press.
As Stockwell predicted more than a decade before, the war in Afghanistan has dragged on, and by the 2008 presidential election, the American public, weary of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, began to look for a fresh face for a new start. Freshman Senator Barack Obama from Illinois had campaigned against the Bush administration's war in Iraq, and many in the U.S. were hopeful that this signaled a potential sea change in U.S. policy. But by July of 2008, with his capture of the Democratic nomination a practical certainty, Obama began to sing a different tune.
Senator Obama spent his first day in Afghanistan yesterday visiting the troops, talking to soldiers, speaking with their commanders. Today he met privately with President Hamid Karzai of Afghanistan. And he says that after talking to both sides, his assessment is that the situation in Afghanistan is both precarious and urgent. And he said that the U.S. has to start planning to put more troops in Afghanistan now.
I believe U.S. Troop levels need to increase, and I've, for at least a year now, I've called for two additional brigades, perhaps three. I think it's very important that we unify command more effectively to coordinate our military activities. But military alone is not going to be enough. The Afghan government needs to do more, but we have to understand that the situation is precarious and urgent here in Afghanistan. And I believe this has to be our central focus, the central front on our battle against terrorism.
Almost 6 years and 1.5 presidential terms later, President Obama visited U.S. forces in Afghanistan this past May.
Hello, Bagram! Well, you know, I know it's a little late, but I was in the neighborhood and thought I'd stop by. I'm here on a single mission, and that is to thank you for your extraordinary service. I thank you as your commander-in-chief, because you inspire me. Your willingness to serve, to step forward at a time of war and say, send me, is the reason the United States stays strong and free. Of all the honors that I have as serving as president, nothing matches serving as your commander-in-chief. But I'm also here representing 300 million Americans who want to say thank you as well. You know, I know sometimes when you're over here, away from home, away from family, you may not truly absorb how much the folks back home are thinking about you. So I just want you to know, when it comes to supporting you and your families, the American people stand united. We support you. We are proud of you. We stand in awe of your service. And you can see it in American actions every single day. You see it in the kids across America who send you all those care packages and all those Girl Scout cookies. Those were pretty popular, huh?
Now, 13 years after the 2001 U.S. invasion and 35 years after the U.S. began training and arming Afghanis to fight both Soviet troops and their own countrymen, war still rages in Afghanistan. A two-person race for president this year stood in limbo without a winner for months and with credible accusations of corruption from both camps, forcing a power-sharing arrangement that violates the new Afghan constitution. And yet, the U.S. is as entrenched now as it was when President Bush kicked off Operation Enduring Freedom on October 7, 2001, a project that, it seems, was all about enduring and very little about freedom. We'll have more on the U.S. war on Afghanistan later this week. With calm restored to the streets of Hong Kong, the government announced Tuesday that it's agreed to meet for talks on constitutional reform with student representatives this Friday. Undersecretary for Constitutional and Mainland Affairs Lau Kong Wah made the announcement after meeting with students Monday evening. The discussion will be open to the media. Chief Secretary Carrie Lam, Secretary for Justice Rimsky-Yuen, and Secretary for Constitutional and Mainland Affairs Raymond Tam will attend the meeting, during which the issue of the constitutional basis and legal basis of constitutional reforms will be discussed with the students. Undersecretary Lau said the government is looking for additional opportunities to communicate with the students in the future. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said Tuesday that excessive demands by some of the so-called P5+1 countries, the U.S., U.K., France, Russia, China, and Germany, have slowed progress on a deal over Iran's nuclear energy program, but he remains hopeful. We have this report from Press TV.
Mohammad Javad Zarif said that the nuclear talks have now reached a critical stage. He added that Iran has presented numerous proposals to the group of six countries, and it's now the other side's turn to demonstrate its will to strike an agreement. The Iranian minister made the remarks at a meeting with former French Prime Minister Dominique de Villepin in Tehran. The French diplomat, for his part, said that a final nuclear agreement between Iran and the P5+1 would affect the entire Middle East region. We're now joined by Mohammad Marandi, joining us on the line from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Mr. Marandi is a professor from the University of Tehran. Professor Marandi, welcome to the program. Iran has, for its part, put forth a number of proposals to the group of six countries. But then we have Iranian foreign minister saying that excessive demands from the other party has prevented the Tehran and the West from reaching a nuclear agreement. Can you tell us why these negotiations have not moved forth as of late?
I think the Iranian president has put it clearly when he said that Iran will not accept nuclear apartheid. In the West, there is this misperception, it seems, that somehow Iran is expected to capitulate and forfeit its sovereign right as an independent country to have a peaceful nuclear program. That is something that the president says is completely unacceptable, and that Iran will not relinquish any of its rights within the framework of international law or the NPT. So if the United States, and the real problem is the United States, the Russians, the Chinese, are looking for a solution. The British, the French, and the Germans really aren't very important. It's the United States that is the stumbling block here. And if the United States really wants a solution, it has to recognize Iran's sovereign rights. And under those circumstances, the Iranians have said repeatedly that they will be flexible and willing to provide any assurances that may be needed to show that Iran's nuclear program, just as it's been peaceful in the past, will continue to be peaceful in the future.
Professor Madani, what are the major impediments in the nuclear negotiations that specifically need to be ironed out?
The major problem really is the fact that the United States has not recognized Iran's right to enrich uranium. And that even if there is talk of the United States accepting this, they want to put on some sort of cap to limit the amount of uranium Iran can enrich. Both scenarios are completely unacceptable to Iran because enriching uranium for peaceful purposes is in accordance with international law, something that any country can do. And a cap is meaningless because Iran right now has a nuclear program that produces electricity. And in the years to come, when Iran's agreement with the Russians comes to an end, Iran will need to provide its own nuclear fuel for example, the Bushehr power plant. And therefore, Iran also wishes to develop other nuclear power plants, just as it also develops wind farms. Iran wants to diverse its energy sources. So the Iranians really have to be able to provide their reactors with their own fuel for security reasons as well as for economic reasons.
Professor Madani, just one more issue I'd like you to address. Former French Prime Minister Dominique de Villepin has stated that a final nuclear agreement between Iran and the P5 plus one would in fact affect the entire Middle East region. Could you briefly elaborate and expand on that notion for us?
It's obvious that this region, West Asia, is facing major upheavals. And countries that have traditionally been aligned to the United States and the European client regime, they've either collapsed or they are becoming more and more unstable. And therefore, the energy source for the future, meaning the Persian Gulf, is becoming less reliable. If the United States and the Europeans want energy security, if they want security for their own territories, because right now, thanks to their own foolish policies and their unholy alliance with Wahhabi regimes, they've created an extremist monster. If they want to deal with terrorism, if they want to deal with extremism, if they want to have secure energy come from this region, then right now they have no option but to improve their ties with the Islamic Republic of Iran. And the litmus test for Iran is for the Western countries to resolve the nuclear standoff and to recognize Iran's rights as a sovereign and independent country. If that happens, then cooperation can begin. Of course, cooperation that respects the rights of the people of the region.
An historic meeting among Palestinian government officials will take place later this week. We have this report from Press TV.
And senior Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh says the National Palestinian Unity Government will hold its first cabinet meeting in Gaza on Thursday. Haniyeh announced the meeting in an exclusive interview with Press TV. The meeting would be held ahead of an international donors conference on reconstructing Gaza. Hamas and Fatah signed a reconciliation deal in April aimed at putting an end to years of rivalry. The cabinet took office in June in the West Bank city of Ramallah, but couldn't meet in Gaza due to Israel's onslaught on the blockaded territory. Following the devastating war, the two Palestinian factions agreed in September that the unity government would take control of Gaza and play a key role in its reconstruction. Let's cross over to Pennsylvania. Joining us on the line is Professor Lawrence Davidson. He's with the Westchester University. Many thanks for joining us here on Press TV, Professor Davidson. Now, first of all, how significant do you think it is for this national unity government to be holding this meeting in Gaza?
Well, I think it's quite significant. It says that Palestinians won't let themselves be intimidated by the Israelis or allow the Israelis to define their governmental structure, who's going to be involved in their government. So if the Palestinians truly aspire to independence, an independent state, they can't let the Israelis or anybody else define that structure or how it's going to operate. So this is a really a very good precedent for the future, whether this particular deal works out in the end or not, this is a very good precedent for the future.
How do you think, though, this is going to be interpreted by the Israelis?
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
How do you think this is going to be interpreted, though, by the Israeli side?
Oh. Well, I think the Israelis will get very huffy and puffy about it. And probably one of the things they might do is try to restrict travel for government personnel, Palestinian government personnel, between the West Bank and Gaza. So they'll try to interfere and put pressure on probably Abbas to do this. Or they might try to start another war as a way of sort of breaking this up. So we can expect the Israelis to interfere or to try to interfere. So I would say the government in Jerusalem is probably upset about this.
Right, but Professor Davidson, in the past when we've seen attempts made towards reconciling the different factions of Palestine into a single national entity government, we've seen Israeli officials say that they will not negotiate with a government that has Hamas officials in it because it considers Hamas a terrorist organization. But at the same time, when it's just Mahmoud Abbas and the PA constructed of just the Fatah movement, Israel again says that it will not negotiate with Mahmoud Abbas because he has no jurisdiction over Gaza.
So, I think the lesson here is that the Israelis won't negotiate with anybody, and certainly not in good faith. So, I guess what Abbas is trying to do essentially is, keep the American money coming while he works for this Palestinian government. But I don't think anybody really feels that the Israelis have any kind of blackmail pressure here because, their history is that they just don't negotiate, period.
And there may be more history in the making for Palestine, recognition by member states in the EU. We have this report from RT.
Sweden's new government says it will recognize Palestine as a sovereign state. If it fulfills the promise, it'll become the first EU member to do so. Now, there are other European nations that share this stance, including Bulgaria, Poland and Romania, but they recognised Palestine before they joined the bloc. Now, Jutta Guttelen from Sweden's new ruling Social Democratic Party joins me now. Why is recognition of the state of Palestine part of your new international policy, and why are you starting with this?
We believe it's important if you want to create a peaceful future to have a more balanced and more equal situation between Israel and Palestine. And we believe that by recognizing Palestine as a state, we contribute to an opportunity to form a two-state solution that we would want to be the future.
If this comes to fruition, then Sweden will become the first EU state to recognise Palestine whilst as a member of the European Union. Do you expect other countries to follow suit?
I hope that this will mean that we take the leadership here in EU and that other states will follow. And as you said in the beginning, we've seen that other states, member states, already done it before they became member states. So we think that this will contribute to a positive situation here.
What's the response been to the proposals?
I believe many people feel joy about it and they feel hope and they see that the surrounding world cares about how to create a stable and a peaceful situation both for the Israelis and for Palestine. That's important for us to contribute to safety and security and recognize the two-state solutions.
It hasn't been such a positive response, though, from Israel, has it, who summoned the ambassador to protest against the idea. Washington has said it's premature. Are you concerned that this could damage Sweden's relationship with both America and Israel?
We believe that we should continue to have positive relations, and we would like to work for that because that's important for us. And we also believe that it's important to recognize Israel's situation and also have a policy that that is created to create stability and security. But I would like to point out that our relation with the United States are better than ever, and we would like to continue it that way.
Now, following the election victory, your party has said that Sweden's international image is one of its main priorities. Why is that such a concern for you? Why is that of such interest right now?
Because I believe that Sweden can play an international role and be bigger than how big we are. We are a small country. But we could contribute by being clear about our values. Our values are based on the respect of human rights, international development in the world, and also about creating a world where we this armament is in focus, because we would like to create a peaceful world. And I think that value should be more visual, people should see it from Sweden more often.
In Syria, it appears that the past 3 years of U.S. covert involvement there may have produced another chaotic scenario like the one that has plagued Afghanistan for decades. Derek Mbata reports from the United Nations.
In a statement issued in New York late on Monday, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said he was following with grave concern the ongoing offensive by ISIL on Kobane, also known as Ayn al-Arab. He noted that the attacks by ISIL had already resulted in massive displacement of civilians, including into Turkey, and numerous deaths and injuries. Corinne Momalvanien is UN spokesperson in Geneva.
In light of the gross and extensive violations of human rights and international humanitarian law, the terrorist group has committed in areas that have fallen under its control in Syria and Iraq during its barbarous campaign. He urgently calls on all those with the means to do so to take immediate action to protect the beleaguered civilian population of Ayn al-Arab.
The UN refugee agency UNHCR has commended Turkish authorities for accepting the refugees who have fled the ISIL onslaught on Kobane. Adrian Edwards is UNHCR spokesperson in Geneva.
I think the Turkish authorities are doing a great deal. They already have a very substantial refugee population. They've taken in, by their numbers, 172,000 people. There's still work going on to try and develop camps where people might stay, but right now people are living in the community, in a school, in a park, in a couple of markets, and then amongst the population at large.
Concern has been raised about the civilians who remained in Kobane as thousands of others fled when ISIL fighters launched their offensive 3 weeks ago. Rupert Colville from the UN Human Rights Office says that up until about 3 or 4 days ago, there were approximately 10,000 civilians still in Kobane, but most of them have now crossed into Turkey.
We understand some of the civilian administrators who were staying in the town have also now left. But we are still concerned, obviously, for the safety of any civilians who do remain on the Syrian side of the border. We're also very concerned about what will happen to any combatants who are captured by ISIL, given their atrocious record, both in Iraq and in Syria, with regard to captured fighters, despite the Geneva Conventions, which apply to them like anybody else.
As warplanes from a United States-led coalition continued to strike targets in support of Kurdish forces, it is hoped that the capture of Kobane by ISIL can be stopped. Derek Mbata, United Nations.
Kurdish fighters in Syria have struggled for the past days to fight off ISIL forces in Kobane, and Turkey's president has warned that the border town was about to fall despite new U.S.-led airstrikes on the group. Meanwhile, Kurds across Europe have taken up the banner of their compatriots fighting ISIL, with several groups storming the European Parliament and some national ones as well. RT's Peter Oliver reports.
Well, these protesters want more action taken. They perceive it as real inaction by Western governments who have said that ISIS is a direct threat to them. They're saying it's the Kurdish people who are doing the fighting on the front line and they need more support. So what we've seen is we've seen these demonstrators taking over the EU Parliament in Brussels, also right here in Berlin right now. There is a demonstration taking place just next to the Brandenburg Gate. Next to the Brandenburg Gate are the embassies of the United States and Great Britain. There's also demonstrations near the Reichstag to try and get Germany to commit more troops to this. But this is just part of what we've seen going on across Europe. The Dutch Parliament was occupied as well in The Hague. Also in Istanbul, there's been more and more demonstrations taking place calling for Turkey to play a key role as ISIS march on towards those key towns, both on the Turkish and on the Syrian borders. Where the Kurds are putting up the real the fight there, and they're saying they need more help, and that's why they're demonstrating across Europe right now.
Meanwhile, the CIA was well aware of ISIL's plans to attack the Iraqi city of Mosul and seize much of Iraq. According to journalist Nafiz Ahmed, author of the Guardian newspaper's article, How the West Created the Islamic State, he spoke with Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford.
I think the idea that the CIA in some way, you know, failed to anticipate the speed at which ISIS would rise and begin to rampage across Iraq is actually a bit of a convenient mythology. We only have to go back to the testimony of the former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency earlier in February this year, and he was speaking to the Senate Armed Services Committee, and he actually spelled out in some detail the extent of the intelligence that they had on ISIS, and he actually said that they believe that ISIS is planning an attack on Iraq for this year. He actually identified some of the areas, the predominantly Sunni areas in Iraq, which were vulnerable to an ISIS attack and vulnerable to the activity of, you know, general Islamist militancy. And he actually also identified the severe weaknesses of the Iraqi army and said that they believed that the Iraqi army wouldn't be able to really do very much about an attack from al-Qaeda or an internal uprising or revolt of some kind that had a link to these militant groups. So a lot of this was really spelled out. And, you know, we've now heard from a number of anonymous sources speaking to various elements of the press, the Daily Beast, Fox News. There's been a couple of these revelations now where these intelligence officials have confirmed that actually there was very precise intelligence from ISIS and their activities and their increasing growth and their encroachment on Iraq. And then actually I spoke to an Iraqi official, a fairly senior Iraqi official, who said to me that in fact the Americans and the Iraqis believed that ISIS was going to attack Mosul as early as August last year. So I think this whole thing of the CIA didn't know or it was the CIA's fault is really a case of finger-pointing, and it doesn't really explain the colossal failures of this administration.
So the CIA was aware of ISIS's plans. You've also said that U.S. intelligence has been fully aware of the political, theological makeup of the Islamist fighters in Syria all along.
Absolutely. Not only have they been integrally involved in financing the rebels and coordinating the financing of the rebels in Syria, many of whom have gone on to break away and you know, become part of ISIS, they've also been tracking these groups and categorizing them and classifying them and trying to understand them. And this has gone on for many years. And if we look at some of the reporting about the classified assessments that were done by the CIA of what was happening to the funding that was being passed via many of our allies, such as Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the UAE, Kuwait, and some other countries. And all of that funding, the classified assessments showed that the vast bulk of that funding was going to the most virulent kind of elements of the Islamist extremist factions amongst the rebel forces. And that's not a surprise, given that we know from previous revelations from intelligence sources and other investigations that have been done by the FBI, by the CIA, that these countries, these Gulf states in particular, have for many, many years been supporting terrorism and supporting Al-Qaeda-linked groups that have very dubious ideas and very sinister tactics. Despite that, we basically were coordinating with these guys to actually support these very same groups, many of whom have actually gone on to form what we now know as ISIS.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.